This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Solar World. We're about to speak to Bob Lyden, who's Executive Vice President and General Manager at Sterling Energy Systems in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome back for the third time to Utopia Media's Solar World.
Good to be back, Mark.
Tell us about this deal you've just signed with San Diego Gas and Electric.
Well, it's pretty exciting. We just had the press announcement yesterday, and it's a 300-megawatt first phase solar power plant to be built in the Imperial Valley. Might be expanded to as large as 900 megawatts when it's all built out. There's two supplemental options to the contract, which each for 300 megawatts.
So and the basic deal is that, like Southern California Edison, they've agreed to buy a certain amount of electric power from you, and presumably that's going to finance the construction of the plant that you're going to use to deliver it.
That's correct. We're actually supplying under a power purchase agreement, 20-year power purchase agreement, all of the power that we produce from the solar dishes that are out at our power plant, and that'll be financed by the cash flow that we anticipate getting from the power purchase agreement.
Okay, how does this compare in size and timing with the deal that you signed 3 weeks ago with Southern California Edison?
It's initially a little smaller. The Southern California Edison contract was 500 megawatts as a first stage. If fully built out, the SCE contract is 850 megawatts. If this is fully built out, would be 900 megawatts.
So that's 1.75 gigawatts.
Yes, that's true. It's a lot of dishes and a very, very big contract or combined contracts. As far as timing is concerned, fairly similar timing. It would be the earliest we would be installing dishes in the for the San Diego project would be in sometime in 2008 time frame. And if it was built out all the way to the 900 megawatts, might not be completed until about the end of 2014.
Okay. And will electricity start flowing pretty much after you put up the first unit?
Yes, Mark. As we think we discussed earlier, the way that these dishes work is each individual dish, it's a 25-kilowatt generating system, and each dish, once it's hooked into the line, can start producing electrons that go onto the grid. As a practical matter, it'll be put in probably 1 or 5 megawatt type of tranches, but as soon as we get a group of dishes installed, maybe a day's worth of installation, we'll turn those on the next day, the SDG&E will start delivering or getting that power for their customers.
Okay. Now, given the lead time that you've got here, would you say that the technology as you've implemented it is perfected, or are there either big or small incremental improvements that you could make in it that might be implemented by the time the project starts or by the time it finishes?
Well, the basic technology is pretty well proven. We've got over 26,000 hours of on-sun time with the with dishes that have been running for us going back as much as 20 years ago. So
right.
We know that the systems work. They're very reliable and durable. But there's always room for improvement. And as we move into high-volume production, which is the phase we're going through right now,
right,
we'll be making some improvements and some changes in order to facilitate more efficient, high-volume, lower-cost type of production. And, you know, as we learn more from our continuing testing program, we're constantly making improvements. So I would expect to see that trend continue throughout probably the next 10 years.
So you're saying most of the improvements, foreseeable ones, are going to be in manufacturing them more efficiently, but that their operation is pretty much going to stay the way it is now?
Well, the general operation will stay the same for probably quite some time. I don't see us doing some drastic thing to change the way the physics of a Stirling engine works,
right,
or something. But many of the improvements right now we're focusing on things that would reduce the manufacturing cost,
right,
or improve the efficiency slightly. As we move ahead, we may start focusing on some other types of improvements that are more related to either higher efficiency and performance, or to things that would make installation quicker and easier, that
right,
type of thing.
Okay. Giving credit where credit is due, say something about Sandia National Laboratories and the role they've played in this project until now.
Well, we've had a great working relationship with Sandia over the last about 8 years, anyway, and Sandia has been working under a contract from the Department of Energy, first with some cost-sharing programs to test with SES, to test the both the efficiency and the performance and the reliability and durability of the equipment for our dish drilling systems. As it's evolved, we've become even more closely aligned with them in a working relationship, and have actually now about 15 of our engineers physically located at the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, and they're top engineers in the solar program, and they have some very, very sharp guys, have been working side by side with our engineers, looking at ways in which we can make the dishes run better, faster, faster assembly and this type of thing, and frankly, be much more reliable. And it's been a great working relationship that we anticipate will continue for the next several years at least.
Okay. Now, I'd like you to account for this big move to solar. I've got three possible reasons, and maybe you could start by giving some of yours, and we'll see whether they coincide, and maybe we can raise mine as well.
Sure. One big thing for the move to solar is general awareness concerning the environment and the need to do something different than to burn fossil fuels and pollute our atmosphere. A second real key thing is that we've got particularly in the state of California, but there's a great deal more political movement in many states to encourage the development of renewable resources, including solar. In California, it's one of the best and most aggressive things in the nation with a 20% renewable portfolio standard, which may be increased to as large as 33%. So I think this is a great credit to the state of California and to the foresight of its leaders.
Say a little bit more about that. That's from the California Public Utilities Commission, right?
That's correct, along with California Energy Commission and the governor's office.
And they've been pushing, that's the first I've heard of what you said, that the mandate for 20% might be raised to 33%.
There's been a movement. The governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, would like to move it up to 33% by 2020.
Right.
Right now, the official thing is 20% by 2017.
Right.
San Diego Gas and Electric has publicly announced that their target is to meet that 20% goal by 2010. And then continue on beyond that point.
So there's real momentum building up here now, isn't there?
There is, and I think as a result of the portfolio standards and the response from the utility companies to go out and request in a very aggressive fashion new renewable projects to come to them, it's really started a kind of a snowball rolling down the hill, I think it's really just a very wonderful trend that hopefully will continue and not require government mandates after a period of time. It will get to the point where it just really runs on its own momentum.
And in fact, these two deals, the one with Southern California Edison and the one with San Diego Gas and Electric, are not subsidized in any way, are they?
That's correct. They're not subsidized by anything at the state level.
Right.
There are existing some investment tax credits at the federal level, which help make the economics work
okay.
A little bit better.
Now, what was the impact of the energy bill that was just signed by President Bush?
Well,
if
there's two primary things in the energy bill that we look at as being really very, very positive for solar. One of them is an increase in this investment tax credit from 10% to 30%. That's a very big impact.
To explain how that works?
Company putting in private investors or a company that has a tax appetite, has profits and therefore has to pay taxes,
right.
Can write off immediately within the first year after the equipment is installed, or as the expenditures are actually made, not even installed, but
right.
As the expenditures are made, can write off right now 10% of the cost of the total cost that they've expended on the equipment. By the energy bill, I should correct that, say that it's actually 30% now.
Right.
But that the bill has a grandfather clause. It expires on December 31st, 2007.
Right.
And then drops back down to the 10% level that's been before the energy bill was signed.
Go ahead.
That's a great boost. Unfortunately, for the as far as the timing of our projects, if it's not extended, and there is certainly some interest and a great deal of action going on in Washington to talk about trying to extend this.
I just talked to Ron Resch at the Solar Energy Industries Association, and he said extending that 30% to a longer term is a high priority for that group.
It is. We're working very closely with Ron's organization, with the Solar Energy Industry Association, and with other lobbyists, including our own in Washington, to try to make sure that in fact does happen. The Western Governors Association is also taking a strong position on this because it just makes a lot of good sense.
Does that mean that Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric would get to write that off? They're just buying the electricity from you. How does that work?
That's right. Actually, what happens is that our investors, folks that we are getting to actually put the money up to build these plants,
right,
will be able to take that tax credit. What it does is it reduces the capital costs on the front end, the net effective capital costs of the equipment,
right,
and makes the projects more economically viable.
Okay. Would it help if other states implemented mandates similar to the one that the California Public Utilities Commission has implemented?
Oh, absolutely. Most of the states in the Southwest have some sort of renewable portfolio standard, but...
Which means, of course, that the utilities need to get that percentage of their power from renewable sources.
That's correct.
That's what the portfolio
is. But it's a different percentage in each state.
Right.
In Arizona, they've just passed an upgrade to
right.
the current thing, which increases the renewable portfolio standard to 5% by 2015 and 15% by 2025. So it's nothing compared to really what is going on and is talked about for California. New Mexico has a 10% renewable portfolio standard, and Nevada has one that grows to 15% by 2013. And so there are other states actually have pretty good incentives. None as good as California, at least of the southwestern states.
What are the obstacles to these other states, some of which have an even higher percentage of their land, which it seems to me the best and highest use would be to generate solar electricity?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that you're saying. Why aren't they doing more?
Right.
And it's partly a political thing. I think that...
What is the politics of it, though? Why can't...
In the perception has been, and this is one of the important things that we're trying to change,
right,
is that solar, for example, is just very expensive. And so if you mandated that the utility companies have to put in a
right.
large amount of solar, it's going to result in a significant increase in the cost of electricity to the ratepayers in the states, which is politically not very palatable.
But is that a fact or a perception?
That's a perception. In the past, it may have been actually kind of a fact. But by going to these large-scale deployment plans like we're doing with SCE and SDG&E, we're able to actually achieve economies of manufacturing scale and be able then to provide electricity to the utilities at very competitive type of prices. So it's not really a significant penalty. And in fact, in some instances, we actually provide or are able to provide the electricity at a price that's it's actually less expensive than the cost of, say, some of the peaker plants that are necessary and used by the utility companies right now to supply their peak power demands. So,
and I was going to mention in the list of why now the big move to solar is the vagaries in the energy markets. We don't have to look any further than New Orleans and the crippling of large parts of the American economy or energy sector because of the dependence on both the fossil fuel economy generated out of there.
Well, that's true, Mark. And one of the things that that is really good about solar, and for that matter, both about most renewables, is that there's no future price inflation to speak of.
Right.
The fuel is free, and so...
And that future price inflation has to be almost guaranteed with non-renewables, doesn't it?
Yeah,
they're not making any more dead dinosaurs.
It's almost inevitable, and of course, you know, when you have situations such as some of the things that are going on now, both weather caused things and just significant increases in the demand for fossil fuels compared to the production rates, it's causing the price of natural gas and of oil and the other fossil fuels to skyrocket. And even if this is only a short-term thing, even if it's sort of a blip on a radar screen and a drop back down again, which is not likely, frankly,
right.
But even if it were, it creates a major havoc for a utility company because it's depending upon the use of those fuels, because suddenly they see this huge price increase in one of their fundamental materials or costs of producing energy, and they can't raise their prices accordingly, and so the price of the electricity, and so they end up taking a huge hit in their profits.
So the stability of the fuel source for solar means that there can be more certainty and more opportunities for investment and generally more economic growth on a more stable basis through the use of renewables.
Yeah, it really becomes solar really becomes kind of a hedge against inflation,
right.
In a lot of other areas too. So it, you know, the price of almost everything goes up over time just because of the way the economy works.
Right.
But this is one area where it doesn't necessarily go up, at least not very much. There's a little bit of an increase for the labor costs and operating the plant and so on.
Right.
And even that, we've agreed in building in the pricing to hold the price fixed for a 20-year contract. So over the next 20 years, from the time we start producing power, neither San Diego nor Southern California Edison will actually have to shoulder any increase.
And that's certainly a lot better than they can get on natural gas or oil prices.
Absolutely.
Okay, you mentioned a few minutes ago the idea of increasing global demand. Say something about the possibility of using your systems to help the Chinese and the Indians and other developing countries skip the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and move into the 21st century with their energy economies in a way that would be non-polluting, renewable, non-inflationary, and not require a global struggle for the last drop of oil.
Well, that's obviously a fantastic potential market. Take China, for example. China does have some large areas where they have good solar resources, open deserts, and these areas would be ideal to put into solar farms and provide electricity that completely bypasses the need to go through coal-fired plants like many Chinese electrical plants are today, or natural gas or other fossil fuels, and right from the get-go they end up with a clean-based economy as opposed to one that's based on burning fossil fuels with the attendant pollution. And this is true. India, you mentioned, is and some of the other countries around India, Pakistan, and so on, are all also very good candidates for solar. As of course are some of the developing nations of Africa and even Mexico or South and Central America.
Chile sounds like it might be a good place.
Chile would be a good place. Certainly parts of several countries in South America would be fairly good places. Brazil has got such a huge landmass that there are parts of Brazil that are not so good for it because it's too far east and there's too much weather conditions caused
right.
by sea conditions and so on around. But other parts of the country are very good for solar. Mexico would be an ideal place.
I can still feel the sun from Mazatlan from 20, 30 years ago. It was so
yep.
strong.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic place. And in fact, we kind of drew a band around the world, around the equator, and a fairly broad band, maybe 20 degrees in north and south, and almost any place where you run into land around there, you're going to find some desert areas and areas that have solar resources that would be very good.
And plus, those are also places that are largely economically undeveloped at this point, too, aren't they?
Well, that's true. And, you know, even though you don't our current focus is on developing large-scale solar power plants so we can get the economies of manufacturing scale
right.
and so on. When you go over to someplace, some of the underdeveloped countries, even putting in a couple of dishes in an area that would provide just daytime power for lights, electricity for a school.
Right. Not to mention a little bit of Arizona, the city you're in wouldn't exist without air conditioning.
Well, that's true.
And there may be other places in the world that are similar that with the electricity that your plants could provide could then air condition themselves and build schools and essentially bootstrap themselves out of the power that would come out of your plant.
Exactly. And, you know, if you educate people, they can drive themselves out of poverty and the poverty cycle and so on much more effectively than... You know, if you're just trying to provide continuing foreign aid or something.
Right, exactly,
so,
right.
So I think that's the long-term potential benefits towards both improving the sort of the plight of the of many, many people in our world, but also in providing economic stability and eventually, political stability as well. Could well be facilitated by widespread application of technology such as our solar dish technology. There's other technologies that also would help.
Right. How actively is Australian Energy Systems pursuing this kind of scenario and selling your products into foreign markets? Or are you going to be doing all you can to meet these two contracts with?
Our first focus, obviously, we want to make sure we're successful with what we've got on our plate right now.
Right.
And because it is a very resource demanding thing to do international development, we have to be somewhat selective in what we do right now. We do have one dish that we deployed in about 3 years ago to Johannesburg, South Africa,
right.
a demonstration dish for the largest utility in the African continent, and we are pursuing discussions with them about how they might become, just to get a technology transfer type of license
right.
from us, and then take this and do the same thing in the African continent that we're doing in North American continent.
Work their way north.
That's right, and there's just an awful lot of areas. Even just South Africa itself, there's some enormous opportunities for providing additional power to areas that don't have any electricity right now.
Okay, say a little bit about the company itself. Is it privately held or publicly traded?
Currently, it's privately held. We have about 350 shareholders. They're all through private placement. All individual investors. We are in the process right now, partly as a result of our focus on these large-scale contracts and so on, looking to some larger-scale institutional type of investors that would come in as well. And this may lead to our going into a public offering in the foreseeable future.
Okay.
To date, we've been very successful in being able to raise money through private markets.
Okay. We mentioned that the two plants built, these two contracts built to their maximum would be 1.75 gigawatts.
Right.
What percentage of the available solar energy just in the Southwest is that going to tap?
You mean how much is available that we're using? Oh,
that's right. What percentage of the available energy are you going to be using with that huge installation?
I don't know. It's a fraction of 1%. It's a very tiny amount.
Right.
There is so much immense solar resources in the southwestern United States.
So there's no practical limit to how much more of this you could be doing.
No, there isn't. The limit really, there is a practical limit,
okay.
I suppose, and that is, as long as we're doing what we're doing right now, that is just producing, electrons that have to go over some sort of transmission lines.
Right.
You start to run into a limitation as just how many transmission lines you can put in and how far you can deliver the power.
Right. Are people working on that, or is that an intractable physics problem? To light the lamps of Maine from the deserts of the Southwest.
Well, there are a couple of different approaches to doing that. One approach, which is a little bit, both of them involve a fair amount of capital investment.
Right.
One is to put in very high voltage DC lines, direct current lines,
right,
which allow you to transmit power on over wires for a much longer distance without resistance losses, and so you get much higher efficiency of delivery.
And there's no real obstacle there except the expense.
It's largely an expense item. Plus, of course, the usual things that anybody putting in a transmission line runs into, and that is the sort of not in my backyard.
Do those lines,
how do you route the transmission lines?
Right. Do those lines have to be above ground, or could they be run underground?
I think when, and you're asking the wrong guy, because
okay.
I'm not an electrical engineer, but it's my understanding that when you get to the high voltages that they require to get the sufficient transfer, it almost has to be above ground.
Okay. And what about generating hydrogen at the site and pumping it to Maine and then using fuel cells to turn it back into electricity?
Well, that's the other approach. I said there are a couple of different approaches. The other one is, in fact, to use hydrogen as a storage medium, if you will, for a transportation medium for solar energy here in the Southwest. And you would then...
Especially if you fuel the transport by... You even put it on trains or trucks and fuel them with the same fuel, couldn't you?
Sure. And you could also... hydrogen is like natural gas or any other type of a gaseous fuel. You can transport it by pipeline fairly efficiently. It would take some modification of our existing natural gas pipeline network to accommodate hydrogen, because hydrogen's a smaller molecule and has
right. But
more tendency to leak and so on.
Right, but you're saying the existing natural gas infrastructure might be put to use to pump hydrogen around?
That seems to be a generally accepted type of an approach that could be used. There may be some instances where you'd have to reconstruct the line
right.
because the steel material used in the existing lines is not compatible with hydrogen.
And in fact, the existing technology that supports the natural gas infrastructure is pretty well developed, and you could figure out how to modify it for hydrogen and then build new plant on that new model.
Well, that's exactly right. And then, if you developed, one of the other things you need to do is to get water. A source of hydrogen is water.
Right.
And the nice thing about it, a very neat thing about it, is that if you take and extract the hydrogen from water, and then when you either combust it again or you react it through a fuel cell, you get water back again. You get the same amount of water that you had to begin with, so it's an infinite supply.
Yeah. I was going to ask about desalinization, but from what you've just said, is it possible to use seawater for the electrolysis to generate the hydrogen and then combust it and get pure water?
It's probably problematical, because the seawater and the other salts and so on...
It corrupts the equipment.
Tend to poison the electrolysis reaction after a period of time.
Oh, okay. What about using this kind of solar-generated electricity for desalinization? We mentioned Chile, and there's the West. A Big Sur might not be a good place for it, but the coast south of there and on down has water and it has sun. Is there a feasible scenario under which they could be combined to generate drink water for drinking and agriculture?
Sure. Desalination can be accomplished by several different processes. One of them is a filtration process that uses a lot of electricity for pumping.
Right.
And the other one is essentially is a condensation or a distillation process, in which you boil the water and you get it into steam, and the steam separates out as pure water and leaves the salts behind, and then you recondense the steam, and that also requires a lot of heat energy. But that could certainly be accomplished with solar, using our dishes or other types of concentrating solar technology.
Okay. Now, speaking of combining solar and sea, there was a segment on California Connected a few weeks ago talking about a plan called Sea Dog in Northern California that was going to use a floater on a column that would be moved up and down by big waves out a ways from the shore, and it immediately reminded me of the reciprocating externally powered Stirling engines that I had become familiar with from talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some possibility there that your technology could be adapted? And they were talking about using that energy to pump water up uphill and then hydroelectrolyze it down on the way down. But is there some model that could use that energy of the reciprocating rising and falling element in the same way that you use that within your engines to generate electricity directly?
Well, I'm sure there is. That it's probably not the best sort of application for a Stirling engine itself.
Right.
But there are many different types of models of how you can use falling water, whether you create it by pumping water up and then falling, having it fall back down again, and
right.
in some sort of a fashion that has a net energy gain, or if you and in some cases you can do it by using excess energy during the nighttime, for example, when there's more production capacity for of power than demand,
right?
And use that electricity to pump water up. To,
certainly, these waves move just as much during the night as they do during the day, as opposed to solar energy, which of course isn't available.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that certainly is. You know, various types of approaches of using tidal currents or tidal motion to create the same up down type of reciprocating action has at least theoretical applicability. Yet there are numerous types of technical issues that have to be overcome, including the fact that the salt water is fairly corrosive and
right.
the equipment is fairly expensive. But there's also been a great deal of work done over the years in using thermal gradients between
right.
water in the shallow close to the surface in the ocean and that down much deeper.
Arthur C. Clarke wrote stories about that 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and I haven't seen an awful lot
no,
of
I haven't
work,
either.
OTEC systems, ocean thermal electricity.
Okay, but for now we've got your system and it works pretty well, so we can
yeah,
see that.
Yeah, and that's... We've had to focus on just one technology pretty
okay.
much.
Now, you've signed contracts now with two of the four big utilities in California. I don't know, I'm sure you don't want to give away any secrets, but are you talking at all to LA, DWP, and PG&E about signing contracts with you as well?
We have conversations going with all of the utilities in the Southwest, Mark, and you know, certainly don't tend to stop with just
okay.
doing work for two.
Okay. How many machines, how many dishes are you going to need to build to, assuming these two contracts are taken to their maximum, how many installations, dishes are you going to have to build?
70,000.
70,000. And where who's going to be building them where? And what's the likely impact on the employment situation as a result of building 70,000 dishes?
There's going to be a lot of jobs created. The engines themselves are likely be built in areas that supply automotive engines, such as the Midwest United States. And the dish structures, right now we're working with Schuff Steel, which is one of the largest steel fabricators in North America. They happen to be located... headquartered here in Phoenix. They have plants in several states around the United States. Most of the structural parts of the things would be fabricated by Schuff Steel.
How do you spell that company's name?
S-C-H-U-F-F.
Okay.
And the mirrors will be made in a number of different locations. And the installations, you know, to install 70,000 dishes will require of course, several years, but it'll also require a lot of people to put the foundations in, to run the connecting wiring that goes between the dishes and collects the electrons from all the individual generators, the substations, the installation and assembly of the dishes themselves, and then there's an ongoing operating requirement, operators to run the control rooms as well as maintenance people, engine repair maintenance folks, people to wash mirrors.
Now, are you going to get involved in training these people yourselves or rely on career colleges to start opening a new solar technician category and start asking people to come sign up for that with federal Pell grants or whatever they get?
Right. Well, that's. I think we'll start out with having to do it pretty much ourselves,
right.
although we've already done a little bit of work with a couple of universities, Arizona State University and University of Nevada at Las Vegas, looking at trying to develop some sort of a solar technician curriculum. It may be that, you know, they're the emphasis, since they're both four-year engineering schools.
Right.
It was more on more senior type of design engineers and this type of thing, as opposed to operating technicians. And,
right. But there'll be room for both.
But there will be, and I think for that, it's likely to go more towards either trade schools or technical colleges, this type of thing.
Okay. Why don't you wrap up by just sort of reviewing what this deal that you've got with San Diego Gas and Electric is and what it means in the context of the ongoing implementation of renewable and solar energy as the sources for power in the U.S.?
Okay. This contract will allow us to produce a very significant amount of electricity for San Diego's Gas and Electric. If fully built out, it'll represent about 10% of the total power that is sold by San Diego to its customers. So it's a very significant addition to their complement of production.
And beyond just that 10%, they're going to be getting the hotter it gets, the more power they'll have, and the more they'll be able to power the air conditioning to keep people cool in the hotter temperatures that are present.
Well, that's right. This 10% is about 10% of the total kilowatt hours on an annual basis, but during the peak load, it'll represent over 25% of the total peak load or peak demand for the utility. So this is a very big deal for both San Diego and, of course, for our company as well. And we look forward to working with such a progressive company as San Diego Gas and Electric. They have been wonderful people to work with so far, and we look forward to a very successful relationship with them over the next 20 years or so.
Does this indicate that the snowball is really starting to use a reverse metaphor of what we're talking about here, which is all hot? The snowball rolling down the hill is an avalanche in the foreseeable future for solar energy?
I would not be surprised to see that happen, Mark, because it's not going to be just our company. It'd be great if it were, I suppose, from a shareholder standpoint. But what this is really telling, I think, the utilities, both the large and the smaller utilities in the Southwest, is that solar has arrived. It is something that is economically viable, and it's telling other companies, such as some of our competitors as well, and probably new competitors that will come into the market, that this is an industry, a whole new industry that's really developing, and one that could become a very significant contributor to the economies of the Southwest.
So and in fact, you've received orders for more solar-powered plants than the nuclear industry has received in the last 20 or 30 years.
That's not too hard to beat.
No, it's not.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, we also, with the 1.75 gigawatts, would be almost five times, I think, as much solar as has been installed in central power generation plants around the world to date.
So this is pretty significant.
Very significant, and we look forward to this being sort of the beginning of what will become even more significant in the future years.
Okay, good. I want to congratulate you on this contract, and thank you again for talking to us and informing our listeners about what the situation is in regard to the generation of electricity from the sun.
Always good to talk to you, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Goodbye.